Welcome to episode 7 of PCSD.
What's the word?
We are taking the podcast on the road.
We are definitely on the road. We are at the Pima County Adult Detention Complex, and we are joined by Corrections Bureau Chief Scott Lowing. Thank you so much for being here.
No problem.
Or I guess I should say thank you for having us, right? Because we are in your office.
Yeah, we pretty much took over his office.
We appreciate you letting us camp out here.
Yeah, thank you so much. So let's get to it. How long have you been with the Sheriff's Department?
So I just celebrated my anniversary, January 10th. I started in 1988 here in the jail. As a corrections officer.
Really quickly, how much have you seen the jail change from way back when to now?
Just like deputies too. They wear many more hats than they used to. When I worked here, I felt I was a glorified babysitter. And the responsibilities that these corrections officers have now and the amount of detail in the documentation that goes along with today versus then is dramatic day and night.
And we're going to get into all of the changes of, you know, the role of the corrections officer. But just a little bit more about you. You were a patrol captain before this. Correct. How has that transition been for you now being here?
Patrol was easy. And the reason I say that is, you know, you always want to put your fingerprint on whatever you're in charge of. And when I was in patrol, that only took about 6 months. I've been here 3 years. It hasn't happened. I have about 3 years left. I don't think it's going to happen. This is a very unique, dynamic environment. It's always changing. And, you know, it's like putting in policies. It's like we're constantly doing the best we can do to make things better. And it is always a challenge. And every day is different. I come to work and there's this problem or this success. And it's very gratifying. But there's always room for improvement here.
And let's talk a little bit about that improvement. We talked about your anniversary, but there is another anniversary that's happening this year for the jail. It was built in 1984. That is 40 years. This is an old facility. Talk about some of the concerns with this facility and some of the options that the county's looking at.
Well, just real quick, a lot of people look at this, well, there's schools that are out there that are much older. Well, schools have kids in them and students that don't live in there 24/7. They're not abusive. A lot of our inmates do things that you would never dream of kids doing in a public facility. So what that does is it causes our infrastructure to wear out. Specifically, plumbing and electrical are our two biggest concerns in this facility. When we replace the pipes in some of our housing units, because they're encased, a lot of them are encased in cement. When we replace the plumbing, we can only replace about 50% of the plumbing. You're still dealing with 50% you can't touch. We've have vent pipes to our sewers that are literally have half inch, three quarter inch cracks in them. They're filled with rust, which does not allow them to vent. The calcium in our facility in Southern Arizona, as you know, is very high. That's very damaging to our faucet controls. We have constant flooding issues with drains being plugged and toilets being flooded. We have so many videos and pictures of water just pouring out of light fixtures and stuff because of the overflow. And then just the electrical in itself being as old as it is, and a lot of the jail has been repurposed since it was built. We have our kitchen, for example, that used to be offices and the old intake area. So the floors don't flow right. The drainage was not made for that, for example, grease and such that you would have in a kitchen. That's one of our big concerns. We have housing units that used to be offices that we've modified into making them as secure as we can. Housing units, we repurpose them all the time. Ideally, we have 2,030 beds. Ideal capacity is about 85% because of different classifications. There are some inmates that can't be housed with other inmates. They have keep separates. They have different statuses. So we can't house them with so many different people. So I can't use every bed in this facility. And what that does is I refer to it, it's like playing Tetris. We've got to fit as many as we can together and do so safely, staying within our classification system and making safety and security our highest concern.
Wow, that's interesting. That's a lot going on. So the Blue Ribbon Commission released its initial findings on the potential need for a new jail. What was your reaction after reviewing it?
I was involved with it a little bit, providing information to them. I wasn't totally surprised. I think initially they had 5 different options. They settled on 2 that were plausible. One is to do a remodel and build another tower. We've been over capacity for some time. We have inmates sleeping on the floor on a daily occurrence. When I say they're sleeping on the floor, they're sleeping on, we call it a boat. It's similar to a foam air mattress, and they have a mattress on top of that, but they're on the floor. And some of them are 3 to a room that were designed to hold 2. So we do have a capacity issue. And what I've seen in retrospect is when I worked here in 1988, every room was a single bed, and they made everything a double, put a bunk in there. And what I found is if you build it, they will come. So building a 5,000 bed jail is not what we want. I think they recommended 3,200 beds, going from 2030 to 3,200, projecting out the next 50 years is reasonable. I think we need to focus on our mental health capacity that we have. Quite honestly, we are not a mental health hospital. We need to focus on other resources outside the jail to deal with our mental health. We have about 1/3 of our inmates right now. I think today's population was 1,745. We have to focus on 1/3 of those are seriously mentally ill, diagnosed. 2/3 of our inmates in the facility are in some form of psychotropic drugs. That's a concern. Jail should not be the answer for that. The other concern we have is if we do a remodel, well, I have to empty out a section of the jail. We're roughly, 600, 600, and 600 east, west, and tower. Where do I put those 600 inmates? The mission facility, best case, holds 400 and plus, almost 500. That's not the answer. Somebody has recommended that the private prison up in Marana is vacant to house it there. That's a low level security. I don't know that. I have not personally toured it, but I don't know if it would live up to our stuff. Then you're dealing with the staffing issue of staffing a satellite facility. That was one of the options they looked at too. And a satellite facility is very difficult to manage too when you have multiple facilities with a significant amount of distance between the two. The other recommendation they have was to build an entire new complex. I like that because we can potentially have other entities come in and fund their rehabilitation, their transitions, all the things that the ancillary things that go with having a jail. That has potential. The price tag is a pretty steep price tag. The remodel, the expectancy out of that is probably only 20 years. Build a new jail, you get 50 years. It's going to take 10 years to do whatever we're going to do. So we have to, I think it's time to seriously address this and start the ball rolling. Depending on the funding source, that can take years to get. So I don't think we've got to do, so we're in a position, we've got to do something. When we first came in here, when I say that, Captain Kumal and myself came in here 3 years ago, we were spending about $1 million of maintenance. A lot of that was because not all the maintenance was getting reported. And what I mean by that, there was a lot of complacency because the CO, the corrections officer, would report, hey, I got a hole in the wall. Nothing would happen. Hey, I got a hole in the wall. Nothing would happen. They got tired of beating their heads up against the wall. And we told them, you spend more of your awake hours here. If your refrigerator at home didn't work, would you be quiet about it after you reported it 3 times? No, you would make somebody come out and fix it. So that's the mentality we passed on to the corrections officers. And we went up to spending almost $3 million a year just in maintenance. And, you know, the way I look at it, because this is all kind of in limbo, there's stuff we still have to do. We can't just put Band-Aids on it because, like I said, it's got to last 10 years. So the way I look at it, a lot of the repairs we're doing, we're putting Band-Aids with splints on. And that's only going to last so long, too. The facts are that this facility is in drastic need for significant refurbishment and or replacement.
Yeah. When you talk about some of the issues, I mean, we're not talking just cosmetic, you know, we'd like to see, you know, something changed here and there. I mean, you're talking about all the way in the foundation and the drain and the pipes. How concerning is that for you, not only for the employees, but also for the inmates to be in these conditions?
So we do everything we can to make it as nice as it can be. It is a jail, but that's not an excuse. We do everything we can to make it clean and livable. We've had issues with some of our outer walls where they do their recreation yards, where chunks of cement were spalling off because of rust issues. In the housing units, the second floor, there's a railing. We had some rust issues with that railing in the cement, and chunks of cement were falling off that to cause potential serious injuries to people. They've been fixed. How long they'll last, I don't know. Will they happen in another area of the jail? They just fix what we find. There's nothing preventative moving ahead. We have one area probably 50 foot long along an exterior load-bearing wall that has sunk probably about up to a half an inch over a 50 foot span. And that's because of some prior drainage issues that weren't addressed. Well, you can't jack it back up and fix it. So it's got some concerns. We've got one housing unit has a crack that starts in the ceiling, goes down the walls, and all the way across the floor. That's one continuous crack. That says something. We're built next to an old landfill. Not the best place to be building a facility that is this tall and this much weight. And it's the design is 1984. This was built to be what they call a direct modular supervision. Well, first of all, direct supervision's probably the best way to go. That's more the industry standard today. And the definition of direct supervision from 1984 to direct supervision today is not the same. What our direct supervision that we do here is you're locked in your rooms or you're out in your day room and an officer makes rounds checking on you. The sheriff likes to use an analogy about when you hire a babysitter. Do you want an indirect supervision? An officer sits there and watches cameras and the inmates do whatever they want. Do you want a babysitter that sits there and plays Nintendo and looks over at the baby monitor every 15 to 30 minutes? Or do you want a babysitter that every 15 minutes gets up, goes peeks in the door of the baby's room to see if they're still breathing? Or do you want a babysitter that's in there with your baby? And that's what the new definition of direct supervision is. It is in the facility, in the housing unit, usually a dormitory style, with no walls, in essence. They're right there. They have little pony walls. They're little bunk spaces. Sort of envision a college dorm without rooms. That's kind of what today's definition of direct supervision is. Now, mind you, not all inmates can be housed that way. You still need those individual cells for those that just don't get along with others or those that need to be protected. And that's what our job is, to protect them and to make them safe and to make this, you know, when I first worked here, we called this the Pima County Hilton because it was a very nice jail. When we get prisoners from Department of Corrections, they didn't want to leave here because this place was so nice. The food was great, which is unheard of in a jail. Our kitchen staff, Frida Stafford, our kitchen manager, she does an awesome job. She is so proud of the food that we turn out. When I used to work here, we used to eat here. I had no problem with the food. We don't do that anymore, but it is, you know, you can smell it throughout the facility. And it's like, wow, that smells pretty good today. Wonder what they're having.
Nice. So more with the Blue Ribbon Commission is set to release its final findings report soon. What would you like to see in it?
I think the best answer for your return on investment is going to be a new facility, because like I said, a remodel is very expensive. I think it's 3/4 of the cost of a new facility, and you're just kicking the can down the road. You're going to have to be addressing it. By the time you finish, you're going to have to start addressing it for next time. And based on our footprint and our where we're located, we can't expand out. One of the other concerns that we have right now, it's about 1/3 of a mile to run from one end of the jail to the other. Our medical facility, and it is a medical observation unit, I would have a hard time comparing it even to an urgent care. Mm-hmm. It's less than an urgent care, but they are running all 1/3 of a mile sometimes from our medical. The new jail, the designs, there's a lot of designs out there. There's a lot of designs that could be better, but little satellite medical offices. For example, our detox. We've got that down the way we want it. There is a nurse in our detox facilities 24/7 because our detox are our highest risk inmates. They're coming off of whatever they were taking in the streets. With fentanyl nowadays, that's the most deadliest drug I've ever seen in my career. And a lot of times what happens is they come in or, you know, they know they're coming in, so they take a little bit extra and that kills them. And it's sad to say, let me say this, one death is too many. And we have, in the year before we came here, we had 9 deaths. Then we had COVID and we had 10 deaths. And then we had fentanyl and we had 10 deaths. This last year, we're down to 8 deaths. So we're making progress. Every time we have a death, and it doesn't even take a death, we are constantly reviewing our policies, our procedures. What can we do better? What can we do? Like COVID, for example, we didn't want COVID in this facility. Mm-hmm. And we could predict what our COVID levels were going to be because we were two weeks behind the county. We had that little buffer to try to do things with. Nobody wanted COVID into this facility. It came into this facility. Nobody wants fentanyl in this facility, except some of the inmates that use fentanyl, and they're trying to sneak it in. Mm. So it's a game of cat and mouse that we have constantly addressed through some of our technologies. We have body scanners, and we've upgraded our body scanners with a second imaging camera, we'll call it. And we have some 18-year-old kids working in our intake unit reviewing these things. And to me, I've seen my x-rays. The way this machine projects, it's a lot more complicated because they have different modes they can look at. And we've had one person come in with over 400 fentanyl pills in their system, meaning they swallowed it, and the kids found it. And I looked at it, I'm like, I don't see it. And what I ended up seeing first was the knot on the bag that they ended up tying that they swallowed. Once I saw that, I'm like, oh, okay, I see it. But it doesn't stand out like, you know, you can picture a knife or a gun in an x-ray. It doesn't stand out like that. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit more difficult to see. We had 2 drug canines in our facility, and we were the first ones to get them trained on fentanyl, to get any dogs trained on fentanyl in Southern Arizona. We expanded to 4 dogs. They're all fentanyl trained. The times that we search our inmates is increased. These are all policies and procedures before inmates are moved. The good news to me, which is not really that great, is 90% of our drugs that we find within the first 72 hours that an inmate's in custody. And because that's a high risk area, a high risk time frame, we've created a detox unit that has they're in dorms, they're glass from floor to ceiling. I have a nurse in there. They're searched before they come in there, they're searched before they leave. And when I say leave, to go upstairs to our general population. And you know, that's the times that we have to find these drugs to keep them for those inmates that, for example, if you're used to taking 20 fentanyl pills on the streets and you haven't taken fentanyl for 6 months and you think you can take 20 fentanyl pills again, you're wrong. It's going to kill you. And that's what a lot of people don't recognize. The same thing happens when people get released. We do everything we can to do what we call warm handoffs so that when we release you from this facility, we give you 7 days worth of meds and we send you directly to a facility that's going to give you the medication. There's several out there. We prefer Suboxone that takes off the edge, that takes away the cravings to get the fentanyl, because I'd rather have you take that safer drug than go out to your street pharmacist and get fentanyl again, because your tolerance is down. It's going to kill you. And we have really worked very hard with that program. We also started a MAT program, MAT, medically assisted treatment. And our goal is within 24, if you have fentanyl, our goal is within 24 hours that we put you on Suboxone. So you're not craving, you're not detoxing so hard, and you're not looking, you know, there's a market for fentanyl to be smuggled in here. We're trying to take away that market by having people be satisfied with Suboxone. And it's got a lot of rules attached to it for a reason. You get caught trading, you get caught violating the rules, you're not going to be on this program anymore. Mm-hmm. It's got a lot of restrictions with it. They have recognized fentanyl usage as an ADA issue, American with Disabilities Act issue. So that's coming down the road. And all facilities are going to end up having to do this MAT program. But we've shown that, or it appears to me from what I see, it has a lot of success in it. We'll talk about searching. So in 2018 is when they first got their body scanners, and we had roughly 150 drug contrabands found in 2018 alone. That went down a little bit in 2019, 2020. We upgraded the camera between 21 and 22. And last year in 2023, we found drugs 271 times coming into this facility. That's almost once a day, but there, it doesn't happen that. Sometimes it's five times a day, and it can be between one pill and 500 pills. We have done other things. For example, we've had a lot of new arrestees get very ingenious with the way they try to smuggle things in. Women, for example, remove their underwire from their bra and they'll stuff that. Men will do stuff with the elastic in their underwear. Now you come into this facility, you wear nothing but our clothes. We give you your underwear, we give you your shirts, your pants, nothing that was on the streets is allowed to be worn in our facility. And I think that has that, along with the dogs, with everything else that we've done to make it safer. Some of the other things that we've done in our facility is we've addressed our detoxes. When Rob and I first came in here 3 years ago, we were averaging 30 people on detox. So we had talked about, you know, doing an addition on that was dedicated, attached to medical, that was strictly a detox. And we were going to plan 40 beds because we thought that would be enough. Well, within a year, we are averaging up to 100 people on detox. We would have already outgrown that. We've implemented a clear bag policy that all of our staff has to wear a clear bag, and they're all required to come in the same entrance so that there's a supervisor there monitoring what people are bringing in. Obviously, we got cameras and all that stuff too, but it's one point of entry and exit, and it's monitored, and all these things that we are trying to do. They're all little, you know, how you eat an elephant, one bite at a time, and this is an elephant that we're trying to address. And we're doing all these things and constantly trying to improve and stay ahead of the game of having the drugs and other contrabands brought into our facility.
You talk about the conditions of the jail, and you talk about the changes and sort of the multifaceted approach to getting stopping drugs from getting in. What do you say to the taxpayers that could potentially be the ones footing the bill for a new jail?
Well, every death that we have in here, we get sued, and I'm not paying the bill. The taxpayer is paying the bill. So we get sued for a lot of things. It's not just death. Don't get me wrong. Some of the living conditions, we have lawsuits that we get sued on. So, you know, and the reason this jail was built back in 1984 was based on a lawsuit. The old jail is what they used to call it, was, from what I've heard, a very gross, disgusting facility. And it was outdated, and it was a lawsuit that required us to build a new jail. Why wait for that? Mm-hmm. Stay ahead of the curve, stay ahead of the game, go above and beyond. make it a state-of-the-art facility, make it, you know, a lot has changed in almost 50 years. And I think that we should take advantage of that. It's like I said, it's pay me now, pay me later, because we're paying a lot for maintenance. You know, if you build a new jail and you stay up on the maintenance, it'll be cost effective. It's a big chunk of change. Don't get me wrong. But when you look at return on investment, I think that's the right way to go.
All right. Thank you, Chief Lowen. We're going to take a quick break on PCSD.
What's the word?
Deputy Magnus and Pima County Sheriff's Department, we're up here on Mount Lemmon. As you know, during the winter season, we have a lot of inclement weather. We have snow. We all like to come up and see it. But please make sure if you're going to come up here that you have your proper attire, warm clothing. Also, make sure you have your proper attire for your vehicle. If the sign states you need four-wheel drive or chains, you're going to be required to have those, or you're not going to be allowed to come up the mountain. And remember, guys, the people down here at the bottom of the mountain are just worried about your safety. All of them are volunteers. They could be doing anything else with their time today, but they want to make sure you're safe on the mountain. So listen to them and be courteous. The lines are going to get long. Every year they do. Just be patient, please. Make sure you keep an eye on the changing weather conditions and call the Pima County Sheriff's Department non-emergency line if you have questions.
Welcome back to PCSD.
What's the word?
We are here with Chief Lowen at the Pima County Adult Detention Complex. We're going to get back into it right quick. So there's been a big push to increase staffing levels here at the jail. How are you doing in terms of numbers?
We're up to close to 90% staffing, which is a lot better than we were before. Our staffing started to go down as a cost-saving measure, and then COVID hit. You know, we went from academies of 20 down to academies of 7, and now we've been running academies of 40 plus, and we're making return. We're getting returns. The downside of that is I have 100 people on probation, and probationary people are newer people. The sheriff has gone out and given every corrections officer a 7.5% pay raise. That helped out a lot. The CBIZ pay study that the county did has helped out a lot. So our staffing has improved a lot. But I do need to mention that when it comes to staffing, when we were at our low staffings, we did not let our high-risk areas suffer. If our high-risk areas, we usually have two officers in there, and we continue to put two officers in there. We were paying out 6,000 hours of overtime every 2 weeks. Every pay period, we were paying out 6,000 hours of overtime to maintain the safe staffing levels. Right now, we're going to be under 1,000 hours, and our goal is, as of January 14th, the sheriff wants zero overtime realistically with different assignments that come up because of hospital post, or we have some inmates that have to have a CO watch them constantly 24/7. That's not built into our scheduling model. My goal is around 200 hours of overtime per pay period. And that is huge to turn around in just a short period of time that we did. I've got three new captains in here. They have all sat down and they have scrutinized the schedule. We've included our lieutenants in it to how can we still maintain the appropriate staffing that we need and still keep it safe and keep it properly staffed. And, you know, like I said, we've never sacrificed our staffing in those critical areas. We had to cut back on some of the inmates' day rooms. We're back to where they're getting more than twice the day room they were getting before when we were at our short staffings. So we're making improvements. They're getting access to the yards more frequently outside. Some of the housing units have yards attached, so it's only a small percentage that we had to deal with the yard issue. But the inmates are getting their recreation time. We still follow some of the COVID protocols. For example, when you first come in, we had a 14-day quarantine. You had to be housed in a quarantine unit. Now we call it an observation unit, and we've cut it to 5 days. That addresses those. You're only on detox, for example, and I'm trying to go, sorry, I'm going back a little bit. If you admit to using drugs, we put you on detox. If you don't admit to using drugs, you're not on detox, but we still put you in this isolation unit or observation unit for 5 days so we can monitor you. even if you don't want to tell us you were on drugs, it's not, you know, once you're in here, you're best to be honest with us because we can give you care and treatment. And it's painful to come off some of these drugs. So with that 5 days of observation, I have two officers and then we have two of those units and we have overflow. Anytime there's a detoxer in any housing unit, there has to be two officers in there just because it's that much more important for us to be constantly watching those people that are detoxing because they're very high risk. And like I said, we've never sacrificed that. We hired overtime. There were some people that worked 80 hours of overtime, a pay period. That's a lot of work.
Yeah.
And, you know, then I have to deal with the burnout and monitor that. And then you run into sick time issues, abuse and stuff like that. So things are balancing out. I think this last pay period, one person had 50 hours of overtime. That was the worst. But I had fewer people have overtime. So like I said, it's come down significantly and we're making great strides to having the proper staff without the overtime.
Real quick, I want to go back to something you said. Maybe people don't know that. What is a day room for the inmates? Kind of describe and tell us what that is.
Our housing units are all different. So I always refer to the tower when I talk about most of our things. They're individual cells. There's 2 to 3 people in each room. They are allowed to come out of their rooms, take a shower, watch TV, play cards, play dominoes, read books, exchange books, clean their rooms, and walk around. The day rooms are pretty big in size, and they do laps around there, and they can socialize with other inmates that are not in the room with them and stuff. So it's getting out and getting some recreation and some peer-to-peer bonding.
Yeah. There has been some changes in the way the department recruits and trains people. How has having deputies, future deputies, go through corrections? How has that helped?
So a large percentage, me included, were corrections officers before we were deputies. And I love it. I love that program because, you know, our staffing was bad enough. We were hiring overtime. We were forcing deputies to come in here. And some of the deputies that never worked here before, I think, were a little bit intimidated about coming in here and working. Well, now by doing the hybrid academy, where whether you're getting hired as a CO or getting hired as a deputy, you go through the CO training and you work in here for 3 months. And for example, the amount of interpersonal communication skills time that I have, it would take me 3 years in the field to do what I can do in here in 3 months. The amount of searching that I do in here, same thing. 3 months is 3 years. The amount of handcuffing. But the biggest thing is de-escalation skills and communication skills. You learn how to talk to somebody you have nothing in common with. You would not talk to them if you were on the streets. But because you're in here, you're forced to talk to them. And you learn how key and valuable these communication traits can be. We call them interpersonal communication.
Nice. That's good. Yeah. I've heard like sometimes some of the best deputies are ones that came from the jail.
I agree with that 100%. I don't know the percentage. It's at least 30% of our deputies, if not more, used to be corrections officers. And I think this is a great, so real quick personal story. When I moved out here in 1987, I was hired by TPD and go through all their process and, oh, we have a hiring freeze. So I'm like, oh crap, I need a job. Let me go to the jail. So I do an interview and I get hired at the jail. And I was here for 2.5 years and I wanted to be a deputy, no doubt about that. And I tested and I made it. But what made me decide that I would never work for another agency is that family bond I got by working for the Sheriff's Department here in the jail. We really are a family. A lot of us spend more time here with our brothers and sisters than we do with our spouses and kids. And, you know, and you're in a unique situation where people have your back and you've got their back and you build this trust that you can't explain to the normal person. Mm-hmm. And having that family start here, I've loved, out of 36 years, there's only been 6 months I didn't like working for this department. And I realized real quick that it's only affecting me. Nobody else cares if I don't like them. Mm-hmm. And I have a little reputation for being blunt, curt, direct and to the point. but I do care about the people I work with, and I care about the people that work for me. And I really want to retire where I started. This jail means a lot to me, and I am so proud to be in charge of this bureau. We have a lot of good men and women working in here. And for those that have made corrections in a career, I commend them. It is not something you grow up saying, I want to be a corrections officer, but they did it. And that takes a lot of gusto.
Yeah. Nice. Talk about the use of Narcan in the jail and how correction officers are saving lives. I've seen some body worn camera stuff. So kind of go into that.
Yeah. So we started, we brought in part of the tweaks and stuff that we did because every time there's a significant incident, we do a review panel. We used to do those years ago. For whatever reason, they stopped. We brought them back. And one of the things we brought up from our review panels is, why do we have to wait for a nurse? Even though a nurse is usually, when they respond, they're there within about 3 minutes. Why do we wait? So we went and issued Narcan in August of 21. We issued Narcan to every housing unit. We had, since August of 21, we have utilized Narcan 142 times. So the way I look at it is we saved 142 people. It's safe. It's very safe. If you don't need Narcan and I give it to you, there's no side effects. But to see somebody who you know is dead come back to life, that's a very impressive thing to see. And it is, you know, it is a very good thing to have. Unfortunately, now there's a thing called xylazine or Trank that these drug dealers like to now infuse in fentanyl because it's supposed to expand your high. Narcan doesn't work on that. And I think it's already found in a small percentage of the drugs that are seized. And I think that's the next step to making this a more fatal issue.
You said earlier that fentanyl is the most dangerous drug you've ever seen. You've been on the streets for 30 plus years. Why do you say that?
Because it kills you. I mean, there is. So meth, I always thought meth was bad because it's psychologically and physically addictive. Very hard to get off of. Heroin, psychologically addictive. Cocaine, physically addictive. You're only dealing with one mentality. With fentanyl, you're dealing with both those. Plus it kills you. It's toxic. It's unbelievable. Understood it was used as a painkiller like every other good drug out there, like morphine and all that other stuff that people get addicted to. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, it's not prescribed by a doctor and it's not controlled by the FDA. The amount of fentanyl you get in this pill is not the same you get in this pill. You've always heard the saying that one grain of salt of fentanyl can kill you. And when they mix it in the pill, that's usually mixed with Tylenol. You don't know how many grains of fentanyl you're getting in there. And that's the dangerous part of it.
So when you're talking about catching, you know, sometimes hundreds of pills and it just takes a tiny, tiny bit to kill one person. I mean, you're not just saving one life. You have the potential to save thousands.
I agree 100%. It is so concerning when I hear that we find one or we have somebody that overdoses and we use Narcan on and bring it back to life, that we are in there doing shakedowns is what we call it when we do extensive searches of the housing units. We are doing 2 to 3 of them to look for maybe that one pill that's still there. We do everything we can. And some of these arrestees and inmates in here are pretty ingenious where they store stuff. And it's, like I said, it's a game of cat and mouse. And, it's just, that's why we got the dogs and everything else that we can use to help us find it.
Before we started this podcast, you said you'd like to address the accusations of being a deadly jail. Talk about that.
So we've had a reporter who has, in my opinion, gone out of his way to focus on us and the amount of deaths we have. They're all numbers. And, we can make numbers say a lot of things. Like, for example, since 2009, that's what we keep our stats back to. I can show all but 3 years, it's safer to be in our jail than it is to be in Pima County. Last year alone, Maricopa County, they have twice the number of beds that we do, but they had 5 times the number of deaths that we had. They had 42 deaths. We had 8. That's a lot more. And Oklahoma County, they're building a new jail because they are the second deadliest jail in the United States. The Department of Justice Statistics used to keep these stats. And because it was somewhat of a voluntary reporting system, the Bureau of Justice, Department of Justice said, well, we're going to make the Department of Administration take it over. And if you receive federal funds, you don't get these federal funds unless you accurately report your death. Fortunately, we don't receive federal funds, but regardless, they don't share those stats. Those stats have not been shared since 2019. A lot of stuff has changed since 2019. COVID, fentanyl, leading cause of most deaths in our facility. Also, from the time I worked here to now, we have a population of inmates that are in declining health. We have a lot of inmates that have chronic health conditions. We didn't have that when I worked here. We had maybe one housing unit that we called our geriatric unit. That's where those people lived. Now they're throughout our entire facility. The health, it's just, they're just not a healthy type of people, whether it be drug use, whether it be lifestyle. I don't know the answer to that. But the point is, the inmate today is not the inmate it was 10, 15, 20 years ago.
You mentioned the distance from the medical facility to get to different places of the jail. And then you also mentioned it being a little bit less than an urgent care. Do you think that upgrading those facilities or changing the way you address medical issues might help? Or what do you think the answer is?
I think the best answer is to build us next to a hospital. In all seriousness, we transport sometimes 100 inmates a month to the hospital for care, for acute chronic care. Sometimes we have inmates going to dialysis 3 times a week. You name it. We have every disease or condition you have on the streets, we have here in the jail. And some of them, probably if they weren't here, they would be in the hospital a lot more than they are. But we don't. It is our medical provider's decision whether somebody goes to the hospital. And if they got to go, we take them. And that hurts our staffing too, but that's the right thing to do. But it becomes a security issue. I would love to build a new jail right next to a hospital or have a hospital in a jail or something like that. But it's very difficult. You know, we have staffing issues, so does medical. And, you know, we have a full-time doctor. I would love 3 full-time doctors, and I would love, you know, 3 or 4 physician's assistants, and it's just in registered nurses, and there's a shortage there, but they make do just like we did, and they're getting better. We go through a lot of medical staff. It's not the best place to work. And if you're a nurse, and you know, it is kind of a quasi-government, even though it's a private provider funded by the government, I can make a heck of a lot more being a traveling nurse or working in a medical facility. And I probably don't have to work 5 days a week when I work in a hospital. So, you know, there's pros and cons, and it takes a unique individual to work here.
You said it takes away from staffing issues when an inmate has to go to the hospital. What do you mean by that? What happens?
So we're still responsible for their security. Depending on their status, I have to send at least transporting them. I have to send at least 2 officers. When they're there, depending where they are, I have to have, and what their status is, I sometimes have to have 1, 2, or 3 officers babysitting 1 inmate versus 1 officer babysitting 70 inmates. Mm-hmm. So it's a ratio thing. And then they've got to be weapons qualified. Not all of my corrections officers are weapons qualified. They have to be weapons qualified to leave the facility with a prisoner. So it's a burden on us, but we're going to do what we got to do.
Is there anything that we have not asked you that you would like to address?
Let's talk about transitioning coming. We talked about it briefly about how it's a challenge, but when we came here, it was a result of an election, and Captain Kumal and myself replaced 3 corrections captains. They were corrections officers from the beginning. They grew up in this facility. They all had 25 years experience. They decided to retire as a result of the election. So Rob had no jail experience. I had 2.5 years 30 years ago. And we had to prove ourselves. Or I don't know if that's right. We had to earn trust because you know, the way a lot of the corrections officers looked at it is we took away a promotion opportunity for them. And here we are coming in from the outside and telling them how things were going to be done. And it was a challenge. And Chief Lopez went in and we talked to the staff a lot. And we told him, you know what, here's what we believe in. Respect, accountability, communication, and professionalism. Because they were lacking here. This place was referred to as a high school atmosphere. And we wanted to bring some professionalism in. And yeah, those sound like nice words to say. But in 3 years, I think that we've proven that's what we really do believe in. And I think we've earned the trust of a lot of people. And I have been brutally honest with people. I am very transparent, as is our sheriff. And that's a double-edged sword, especially with the media. No offense. that they take it and run with it. You know, the jail desk is a good example. I've got the numbers going all the way back to 18. I guarantee you they weren't all reported like we report them, like we report them now. The trust thing is huge. The jail is a unique place. I can go and walk in that hallways here and I can feel the tension, the morale, and I can tell you it's improved a lot. Still got a long ways to go, but we're making strides. And, you know, we mentioned that we replaced myself and Captain Kamal with three captains. Two of them are commissioned, one is corrections. So we've opened that door back up. What the future is, I see it getting better and better, bringing back. I like the commission influence because we think different. Mm-hmm. But I have no problem with a lot of the command staff being corrections officers.
You said 3 more years.
3 years, 11 months.
But who's counting?
Who's really counting? besides a new jail, what would you like to accomplish in those next 3 years?
I honestly, what I would like to see is our staffing go even higher. That's a cost issue because when I worked here, one of the housing units I worked had two officers in it. And it was so nice to come to work to have the same person sitting next to me wearing tan and not orange. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I didn't come to work, I was letting him down. If he didn't come to work, he was letting me down. The bond we built. I would love to see every housing unit staffed with two officers. That takes another 100, 150 PCNs or positions that need to be funded. That would be my goal in the next 3 years. That's one of my biggest ones. And in making this a pleasant place to work, a fun place, some place where you look forward to going to, not a job, mm-hmm. a career, almost a home.
Mm-hmm. All right. So now we're going to shift gears a little bit because the topics that we've been talking about today, they're heavy topics, but they're important ones to discuss. And so we appreciate your honesty and kind of walking us through everything that happens here. But we do want to shift gears to something a little lighter and our favorite topic.
Yeah. You know what? Visit Tucson. I was watching something on Facebook and they were talking about, you know, Tucson having some of the best Mexican food. And I agree with them. Tucson has some of the best Mexican food. A guy coming from Connecticut who didn't eat Mexican food. This place is awesome. So Chief Lowing, what's your favorite Mexican food place in Tucson or Pima County? And what is your favorite meal there?
So unique. I grew up in Michigan and my idea of Mexican food was chichis, if you ever heard of that or remember that. Not what we would call Mexican today. And the only Spanish I know is tactical commands. So
helpful, very helpful.
But so I'm not the best resource for this, but hands down, Guadalajara Grill is my favorite. Their homemade salsa in front of you is just amazing. And I get the carne asada burrito every time. Never disappointed. And then when it comes to beans and rice, there's other restaurants I like. For the El Molinito, I think I like their beans better. And what's that place at St. Mary's and I-10 behind the McDonald's? St. Mary's and Silverell.
Mosaic Cafe. They just reopened.
Yeah.
That's number two.
That place is awesome. And it's got great views. Yes. Like if you sit by the window, you can see the whole city. Yes. That's a great
You know, we are
night.
Close to there today, so we might have to take a little detour. Yeah, those are great choices.
Yeah, thanks for a white guy.
Hey, what about you, Kevin?
That's really tough. I like Guadalajara's, but I like the original El Charro.
Oh, yes. Downtown.
Just going downtown. It's a great place where we take, you know, we have people coming in from out of town that never had great Mexican. We always go to El Charro. And a chimmy. I love chimichangas. Oh, man. Love chimmies. Love chimmies. It's great with the sauce and, oh, man. And some great guacamole, some salsa, some chips. Call it a day. Maybe a nice ice cold adult beverage and we're good to go.
Yeah, I love that. Well, from someone who is from Arizona, I'm very proud of both of you guys for picking some very authentic places. very, very good. I'd have to say for me, La Parrilla Suiza, we've been going there since I can remember. I think one of the first time I had spicy food was eating the guacamole with some of the jalapenos there. So that place, but I also grew up in New Mexico. So I'd have to say Goitas in Oro Valley. Mm-hmm. Their red chili is fantastic. So
there you go. There's your little shout out to New Mexico.
I know. Well, it's hard. You know, I'm from Arizona, but I grew up in New Mexico. So you have that, you know, combination of have to have the green chili, but also have to have the Sonoran side of things. So it's hard to pick, but it's a good problem to have, right?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, just because we picked a few, there are a ton of great Mexican places here. So I don't think you can go wrong. Everything is great and good and I'm hungry now.
Now I'm hungry. Yep.
That's true. I don't think I can ever say I ate at a bad Mexican restaurant.
Yeah. They're all good. Everybody's got a little twist to something. Yeah, exactly. But I love being here and the great food. So Chief Lowing, thank you again for giving us this inside look to what's happening here at the jail, the future of the jail, and your future endeavors with this facility. So we thank you for that.
No problem. Anytime.
Thank you. All right. You've been listening to episode 7 of PCSD. What's the word?